Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Bruce Gogg is a lawmaker in Idaho.
I thought I'd join the legislature to talk about taxes, but here we are. I get the F-bomb phone calls as part of the job.
Now, this is him about a year ago talking to a group called the Idaho Freedom Foundation about a law he co-sponsored that would punish doctors with up to a decade in prison for providing gender-affirming care to young people. Now, these are doctors who would be following standards set by the American Academy of Pediatrics, work that is widely accepted in the medical field. Still, the new Idaho law bans puberty-blocking drugs, hormone injections, any surgical changes that might, quote, induce transient or permanent infertility. So that means doctors can't offer this care, even with the consent of parents.
According to our Supreme Court, for procreation, to have children, and if it's a fundamental right, that is the highest standard.
Okay, that bit about procreation, this is important to his argument for the bill.
A parent can't give up that right for their child. They cannot consent to that or should not be allowed to make that decision for their children. Because I'll hear, well, it's up to the parents. They can decide. No, you can't take away your child's right to procreate. You cannot. And that's part of the reason we're taking this bill forward also.
This week, Representative Skog and Idaho lawmakers notched a minor win with the U.S. Supreme Court. The justices plucked this case from the emergency docket and issued a ruling that says, in effect, despite ongoing legal challenge from some families of trans kids, the state is allowed to temporarily enforce this law against doctors. So today I'm going to share with you a conversation I had back in 2022. It was in the first weeks of this podcast. But it's going to give you a peek at what it looks like to be doing this work in the current legal environment across the country, not just in places where, like Idaho, it's fast being criminalized. You're going to hear from some pediatricians who work with transgender youth who have become targets for people who believe that that work is morally wrong and are willing to do almost anything to make that point.
The FBI has arrested a woman for making bomb threats to the Boston Children's Hospital.
The hospital says it's being inundated with threats because of what they call misinformation about their treatment of transgender patients.
A growing number of doctors say they are under threat from far-right activists because they care for transgender patients.
What these doctors describe is a constant stream of online threats and menacing letters and phone calls and street protests. And it wouldn't be the first time that U.S. doctors faced personal threats for providing certain kinds of medical care, like, say, abortions.
We've been picketed since 1975. My office has been blown up. We have had 4,000 people arrested outside my office in 1991. 1993, I survived an assassination attempt.
Now, I don't know about you, but for me, there's a bit of deja vu here, because today we all take for granted that abortion clinics are built like fortresses with protesters behind barricades and chaperones for the patients to the front door. But that's because between the 70s and 80s, there were more than 100 cases of arson and bombings against abortion clinics across 28 states. There were murders and attempted murders of doctors and medical staff. That's not the future that gender-affirming care doctors want for their field.
What we need are more people doing this work and brighter people doing this work. And I'm concerned that, like, if you're a medical student or a young pediatrician, who would choose to go into a field when this is what they may face?
I'm Audie Cornish, and this is The Assignment. Okay, first, what actually happens in the offices and clinics that are drawing so much attention? I mean, there's no shortage of misconceptions surrounding the field.
Oh, there are so many. here's your hand sanitizer, here's your puberty blockers on your way in. Yes, that's not how we operate.
That's pediatrician Dr. Angela Gepford, who identifies as queer and non-binary. In 2019, they founded the Gender Health Program at Children's Minnesota. They're the medical director of that program. And since its opening, Gepford estimates that the program has served nearly 600 trans youth in the region. And it's got a year-long waiting list, probably because it's the only program of its kind in the state. Parents and patients find it a lot of ways. Recommendations from pediatricians, from family therapists, just searching around online. So a parent comes in, maybe their child is 10 or 11, and they're hearing all kinds of aspects of gender-affirming care, probably through the media. What are the first conversations like?
Well, at our program, and I can't speak for all programs, but at our program, it's an integrated model. So they're going to have an intake with a mental health clinician first.
So it's the whole family sits down in a room with a person who starts asking what kinds of questions?
Asking about the family system, the child's health history, their mental health history, what's happening at school, and then getting into, you know, why are you here today? What do you want to talk about gender identity? Tell us what the journey's been so far and what questions you have and what struggles you're having.
What kind of answers do you get?
Really varies. You know, sometimes families have been supporting their transgender child from the time they were very young, 3, 4, or 5 years old. They've socially transitioned, meaning they're now wearing clothes and outwardly expressing through name, pronouns, and other things the gender expression that's aligned with their identity. Sometimes that's been happening from a young age. They're now coming in because their child is starting puberty and they're wanting to ask more questions about that. Sometimes their child has just started asking questions about their gender identity for the first time and parents aren't sure what to do. Sometimes they've just been in the emergency room because of a first suicide attempt for a patient and they're scared and they're hearing about their child's gender identity. They worry this might be distress related to that and they want to get help.
The care part includes a range of things. Therapy support groups, referrals to vocal coaches or hair removal. It could even include letters for legal name and gender marker changes. And, if warranted, hormones. And this is what the major medical associations, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, this is what they have agreed on when it comes to what's clinically appropriate for adults and children.
There's a big misinformation campaign to position gender-affirming care as surgeries on kids' bodies, and that's just not the case. Surgeries on any transgender person who's under the age of 18 are pretty rare, and certainly nothing that would ever happen for a child. And for many kids, it's no medications at all. That's the other misperception. A lot of what we're doing is talking to families, answering questions, helping them navigate school and grandparents and clothing. Not all kids are going to be receiving medications for their care. There's no kind of factory cookie cutter approach to this care. We're working with each kid, each adolescent, each family on an individual basis and tailoring their care to what works for them.
But Gepford says these days parents are likely to wade through a lot of anti-trans material. Articles questioning this work, questioning the science.
I would actually say most parents come in hesitant. And I don't know that that's because of the recent negative attention or just because it's a big deal.
Yeah, it's high stakes, right? It's your kid.
It's your kid. And in some cases, you as a parent are being asked to help participate in decisions with them and with a healthcare team that may have long-term implications for their future. And it's hard. So I would say most parents come in a little weary. I mean, grateful for the information, grateful for the help, but they're not sure when they come in what comes next or where this is going to go.
What is something you want people to understand about what it's like to be doing this work right now?
I think what I want people to know is that it shouldn't be this hard. At times what it feels like is wanting to say, hold on, you know, hold on a second. You need more accurate information. You need to understand more about these kids and teenagers that we're providing care for. You need to listen to their stories. You need to know what their lives are like, because you're making a big mistake.
So the program launches in 2019. Is it controversial out the gate, or like, what's the vibe?
Unexpectedly, no, actually. We launched pretty publicly. We were on the front page of the local newspaper here, the Star Tribune, and really didn't hear much.
But a few years later, the messages started. Dr. Gepford says they more or less sound the same. Still, I asked them to read one.
Do you want me to read it verbatim?
Yeah.
It has foul language in it.
That's okay.
It says, you need to have your license stripped. F***ing groomer. Children are not trans. They think they are because people like you tell them they are. When I was a child, I liked to wear my mom's heels and dresses. You would have told me I should have been a woman, and I would have grown to kill myself like most trans. You think you're doing the right thing, but you are a borderline pedophile. F*** you.
I'm sorry to make you relive that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, certainly not pleasant.
This is the kind of message they have to turn over to the hospital security team. How should I say this? It feels like we've seen this movie before, so to speak, when it comes to abortion clinics.
Yes, it does feel familiar. I mean, this is the way I have felt over the last, you know, year, specifically kind of the last 6 to 9 months, is how my colleagues who've been, you know, women's health providers or abortion health providers have felt for years. And there's kind of two strategies when it comes to attacking reproductive rights, and that's attack the providers and attack the patients. And some people do more one than the other. And I think that that's exactly what's happening for us, both attacking the providers and attacking the kids.
And when we dug into the news archives about this, for violence after the 1973 Supreme Court decision on Roe v. Wade, it's a lot.
In September, this Reno abortion clinic shut down after someone dumped a nauseating chemical inside.
Blockades of clinics that perform abortions. Acid attacks and other vandalism.
The Redding, California Feminist Women's Health Center was firebombed 3 times.
People were shot, both patients and doctors.
Late-term abortion doctor George Tiller has been gunned down during services at his church in Wichita, Kansas.
And then there were, and continue to be, reports of the protests, lawsuits, and state legislation to ban procedures. So even though at that time abortion rights were constitutionally protected, access became a huge issue because clinics shut down. Given the history, it's not a stretch to say that we could witness the same thing play out when it comes to care for transgender kids. Coming up, a doctor who has been at the center of these attacks speaks out.
Someone somewhere is going to get hurt, and it's like that when it's going to end. You know, like, there's no room in this discussion for this kind of hate.
More in a minute.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace.
Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
You know, Dr. Garofalo, I'm going to start just by saying that this is the kind of interview that it's nerve-wracking as a journalist to ask people to do.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But are you scared to be doing an interview?
Yeah, actually, this is the first time that I've ever sort of been nervous.
Rob Garofalo is in Chicago, which is where he co-directs the gender and sex development program at Lurie Children's Hospital. And he's also in charge of the Division of Adolescent and Young Adult Medicine. One more very important credential to mention here, he's also among a handful of researchers behind what might be the only National Institutes of Health-funded study looking at the outcomes of medical interventions for gender-affirming care in youth. So he's got a long history in this work, and he feels like he's watched this slow rise in what he calls misinformation about gender-affirming care.
If you would have told me 5 years ago that this is where we would be in the current discussion around gender-affirming care, I might never have believed you. You know, I think it was like during the Obama administration, the attorney general said that transgender kids and adolescents were seen. And that was, for me, like a seminal moment. And for, you know, many reasons, I think that optimism has just slowly eroded over the past, you know, 3 or 4 years. First, I think sort of insidiously and sort of slowly. And then I think over the past year, it's become much more organized and directive and structured and pervasive.
When it was insidious, what did it look and feel like? Can you give an example?
I mean, I think there were always parts of society or segments of our culture that question some of the work that we do, right? I mean, there are, I want to be careful how I say this, so let me think about this. Wait, let me think. Can we give this some thought for a second? Sorry.
No, and I want you to take your time, because one of the things that I've noticed about the reporting on this, people can be taking it out of context pretty quickly.
Yeah. So I'm being, I give a lot of interviews over the years, and the level of anxiety and just concern I have about saying something that might be like incorrect or easily mischaracterized or reframed is super high, even as we're having this conversation. And that's just so crazy to me on some level, you know, but that's the world that we live in. And so I say insidious because there's always been sort of an undercurrent of a segment of our population that have been concerned about the work that we do, that's either wedded usually in cultural or social or even religious mores. What I would say has changed recently is just the tone and the pervasiveness of the rhetoric, which has gotten increasingly hostile and wedded in, I think, intentional attempts to misrepresent the work that we do, intentional attempts to mischaracterize the work that we do. And in some ways, I think really has nothing to do with health or healthcare.
Yeah, because now you're in an area of what we would call politically sensitive medical care.
Yeah, I mean,
abortion would be under that, I think,
correct,
that label in that category as well. Do you remember a specific moment, event, where, you know, you felt like something isn't right?
Well, yeah, I mean, a couple. I mean, one, I think when the legislative bans started to happen really over the course of the last year, I think many of us were put on alert that, you know, shit was about to get real, pardon my language. So that was over the past year. But then a few months ago, you know, I had an incident. I was actually in Nigeria where I'm doing work for Global Health.
So you were a world away from Chicago.
Correct. I was in Lagos, Nigeria, really like unaware in some ways of what had happened on sort of the local news. And I listened to the voicemail, and suddenly there was a man who said that I was a piece of shit and was going to rot in hell, and that he hoped that someone would run me down with a truck and kill me. And for me, that was a moment where I was just like, what the f- is going on in the world?
Yeah, what is this? Right. Why is this happening?
Exactly. And then I turned on the news, quite literally, you know, and I happened to be CNN because that's what we watch. Then there was a story about the bomb threat at Boston Children's Hospital. And so I logged onto my Twitter account, which I don't often use, and there were just hundreds upon hundreds of sort of messages related to a erroneous video that was a splice job of interviews I had given, which had completely mischaracterized what I do, who I am, how I feel with regards to the care that we provide to these kids. And so it was in that moment, thousands of miles away from Chicago or the United States, that I knew that this was going to get bad.
You know, people using your own words against you, right? Like taking interviews you've done, manipulating them, cutting them in a way that, as you said, is like mischaracterizing your work. Did that feel scary, personal? Like, what did you think of like the kind of impact of that?
Yeah, at first it felt just violating, right? You know, and in some ways, very personal on any one of a number of levels. And it just made me both sad and really enraged. I mean, I was really mad that like this was actually happening.
What does it look like? What does it feel like to be the focus of a kind of, just to start, social media onslaught?
I mean, honestly, none of us who are pediatricians sort of went into this work to be prepared for this. So it was just felt really overwhelming. It's almost like a wave crashing on you in some ways, because you're just ill-equipped, I think, to manage just the sheer volume of messages. You know, I mean, all of a sudden, something that I had posted had 500,000 viewers and comments. And so it was sort of being, without your consent, thrust into this world that was filled with vitriol and hate in a way that just was deeply upsetting and really hard to manage. I mean, I would just describe it as just draining. I mean, I had a woman in my building, you know, who watched one of the videos on Twitter, like harass me in the lobby, calling me a groomer and saying that I'm not even going to say what she said because I don't want to give those words airtime, but saying that I did things to children that is just repugnant and crazy, honestly.
So Dr. Garofalo says this leaves him and others in a kind of catch-22. Speak out, see your words twisted against you, say nothing, and let the misinformation take over any meaningful debate. So it's no wonder he and his colleagues are nervous to speak out.
Right, because the hatred now is so targeted towards harming people and violence that it makes it difficult to know exactly what the best strategy is to respond, you know, for fear that any sort of response, either on social media or in real life, will sort of foment even more vitriol and anger and hate. And so that's, I think, a really unique aspect of this and has caught many of us and even pediatric institutions a bit off guard as to how to best respond.
What we are hearing about is that some clinics are, for instance, taking down the images of the medical care providers, right? Like taking down phone numbers off the websites, basically becoming less visible.
Oh, for sure.
Which seems kind of like the opposite of the mission in a way.
Completely. And that is exactly what's happening. So people are scrubbing their presence to the outside world, either their social media presence, their websites, scrutinizing material that's being distributed to patients and families. And that's, I think, carefully designed to limit access, right? I mean, you know, so by doing that, the very people that we need to reach are suddenly now not being reached.
It seems like the effect of this is naming and shaming of doctors. Have we seen this before?
Oh, I mean, for sure. I mean, you mentioned it earlier, the reproductive justice field around abortion is, I think, a really good example of where we have seen this before.
Has that come up as in an area of conversation in any way? I mean, I don't want to force the analogy on you.
No, you're not. I mean, it's a real analogy. And I think many of us have asked and reached out to, abortion-providing organizations around communication strategies or safety for ourselves or for our patients. So we are trying to quickly, learn from one another and not reinvent the wheel, because this, while I think what is new, I think, is this is targeting pediatricians, as a field. The stereotype of the pediatrician is like a very kind person, like hugging a teddy bear, right?
Yeah, it's with lollipops in their coat jacket.
Correct. We're very kind and loving, and so the stereotype is in complete opposition to what the current rhetoric is saying. And I'm being really careful not to repeat the words, that are being used, in part because I've been told now, as some of the new communication trainings that we've received, to be very careful, not to repeat those words for, again, fear that they're going to be misquoted, misrepresented. And so, to your earlier question, this is not new. It's just in some ways new targeting this particular population and these particular providers.
When I think back to the 90s, though, that ended in some murders of doctors.
Well, I get emotional even just thinking about it in some ways, because one of my thoughts when I answered that phone call in Nigeria, honestly, my first thought was someone somewhere is going to get hurt. And is that when it's going to end? Is it going to take someone getting hurt to wake up people to the reality that there's no room in this discussion for this kind of hate? I mean, there are very real debates that maybe need to be had, but they can't be had in an environment where violence and death threats are ruining the day. It honestly has kept me up at night sometimes, just fearing that one day, a colleague of mine or someone that I care about and know and love, may get hurt. And whether that's a doctor or a staff person or even worse, a parent or a patient, I mean, that's just really hard to sort of navigate when you're when your training is really just designed to care for people and make them better, and provide them an environment that supports and affirms them.
Have you wanted to stop doing the work?
Oh,
and I don't mean
never.
This. You're saying that, but you are on the edge here. Your emotions are right here.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. But I've never once even considered not continuing to do this work. In fact, even with my emotions, which can run high and hot, I am more committed than ever to making sure that these young people and their families have the access they need to what I am convinced is life-saving care.
What about the next generation
yeah.
of care providers? So what happened with abortion, right, is
yeah.
there was a stigma and fewer people went in
yeah.
to learning about those services.
I think that's something that I am really personally concerned about. I mean, I've been doing this work for a really long time, and I very much worry that what we need are more people doing this work and brighter people doing this work. And I'm concerned that if you're a medical student or a young pediatrician, who would choose to go into a field when this is what they may face?
Are you also getting more attention because there are more people seeking the care?
Oh.
And that has raised questions
for
sure. A certain segment of the population.
Yes. So I think Wait, let me think about this for a second, because this is where I don't want to be mischaracterized. I definitely think that part of the concern has been the rapid rise of the sheer number of clinics that are doing this work. And I think there are legitimate questions that the field needs to ask itself about how we train providers and how we ensure that the models of care that we have are as focused on quality outcomes as they are on just access, right? I think for too long, in many ways, the trans community has accepted models of care that the outcome is strictly about access. And what I hope for my patients are making sure that the models we care are as focused on healthcare quality as they are just on access. And but there
what's
has,
happening to that discussion as under this scrutiny?
Well, that's exactly right. You can't have those kind of discussions under this kind of scrutiny because people are afraid to have, I think, very real conversations around some of the unanswered questions around models of care and, you know, ethics. But you can't have serious scientific debate in a context where people are fearing for their lives.
I have to ask because, you know, as we just saw with reproductive rights and the end of Roe v. Wade, it is effective, this kind of sustained naming, shaming, politicizing of medical care. There is now a kind of effective playbook for that.
Yeah.
And there are a great number of states where it was down to one clinic or no clinic. Is that where this is headed?
I mean, it's not where it's headed. It's where we're at in some of these states. I mean, I think there are some states where now there are virtually no clinics where to get this care. And thousands of children and their families now have to really scramble to think about where they can get health care.
On this show, we like to talk to people who we say are kind of living in the headlines. But your story is not over, right? Like,
no.
It feels like this is in the middle of something. What have you learned so far?
I mean, one, I've learned to just have a bit of a thicker skin, you know? Like, I mean, every morning I wake up and I recognize that I am needed to do this work. And that I've got to show up and that I can't afford to be tired or fatigued or cranky or upset, because then the people that want to shut down this work win. And that's a completely unacceptable option for me.
Dr. Rob Garofalo from Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. The Assignment is a production of CNN Audio. This episode was edited by Rena Palta and produced by Asoke Samuel, Jennifer Lai, and Allison Park. Our senior producer is Matt Martinez. Mixing and sound design by David Schulman, and Dan DeZula is our technical director. Steve Lichtai is the executive producer of CNN Audio, and that team includes Haley Thomas, Alex Manisseri, Robert Mathers, John Dianora, Lenny Steinhardt, Jameis Andrist, Nicole Pesaru, and Lisa Namarau. Special thanks, as always, to Katie Hinman. I'm Audie Cornish, and thank you for listening.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.